We've been speaking at some length with Dr. Arthur Hunt in this series on an image-based culture versus a word-based culture about the effects of, well, what does it mean to transition from being a word-based society where all of the things that go along with the printed page, being able to look at a printed page, there it is, there it is in black and white. You can read back over it and check it out, as opposed to an image-dependent culture or society where the images flash before us so quickly and are changeable, and we're not quite sure, given the perspective or, who knows, the technology today, whether or not we're seeing what really was or is, and yet we live in kind of a limbo, suspending our judgment, saying, I just saw something on television, when if we're pressed on it, we'll say, well, I don't know, it might have been edited to make it look that way. What does it do to our notion of truth? More importantly, and this presses toward our subject today, what does the image do to our sensibilities when it comes to religion, the faith? Our guest in this hour says that paganism is based on the image, and we'll talk about that first in this part three, the conclusion of our series on an image-based culture versus a word-based culture. Dr. Arthur Hunt is our guest. If you'd like to join us, our phone number's 1-800-730-2727, 1-800-730-2727. Dr. Arthur Hunt is Associate Professor of Communications at Geneva College, and he's author of the new book titled The Vanishing Word, The Veneration of Visual Imagery in a Postmodern World. Dr. Hunt, welcome back.
Good afternoon, Todd. Good to be with you.
You start to talk about the irrationality of spectacle. We've used that term last time in our conversation. Spectacle, that's what we're left with in an image-dependent culture. But you start the conversation by talking about paganism. How do we get from, well, let's talk about a postmodern world with image-based or image-dependent culture, to paganism?
Well, that's a very good question. Of course, I define postmodernism as a turning from rationality and an embracing of spectacle. And when you come to think about that, those were basic tenets of many of our pagan cultures. If we think about what eventually, say, Rome fell into toward the declining years of the empire. And I do have a chapter devoted to this whole idea of what exactly is pagan idolatry, and specifically I bounce off of Romans chapter 1.
What is a pagan then? How would you define it for the purposes of our conversation so far?
Well, typically when we think of pagans, we think of those who are without God. I think we have a pretty basic view of paganism when we think about it in general terms. Let me just mention a couple of lines from a poem from William Blake's Marriage of Heaven and Hell, when he says, all deities reside in the human breast. Now, according to Blake, the gods sprang from the human brow. Now, unfortunately, Blake believed this about the Judeo-Christian God as well, and so I guess I can forgive him on that point, but I think that we can apply his observation to the chief competitor of the Judeo-Christian God historically, and that has been paganism. Now, Blake, by that line, is saying that once the poets of old had animated the objects of nature in literature and in art, well, after that, a religious system conveniently ensued. However, as we know from history, the poor souls forgot that the Homer had actually been all made up. But soon Homer became gospel. Now, when the Apostle Paul talks about idolatry in the book of Romans, when he says, for example, professing themselves to be wise, they became fools and changed the glory of the uncorruptible God into an image made like to corruptible man and to birds and four-footed beasts and creeping things, and worshipped and served the creature more than the Creator. Well, of course, the Greeks took what knowledge they had of God, however limited it was, and they failed to honor him in the way that he had been revealed, and in turn they devised gods to meet their own appetites. In other words, Paul is saying that idolatry is really the suppression and the recasting of God. So the pagans really were not seeking God, but they were really running away from God. They were worshiping the God of their own minds, so to speak. And what I'm saying is that in a culture where it is very difficult to escape the pervasiveness of images, the devotion we put into the ritual of watching television and going to the movies and attending rock concerts or devouring the latest People magazine, well, I believe that it approaches the same level of devotion that the Egyptians, the Babylonians, the Greeks, and the Romans had for their deities. And so that's what I'm saying.
Now, you identify early on in this part of your book, The Vanishing Word, three elements that typify paganism past and present. You say they are sex, violence, and not rock and roll, but celebrity. Let's talk about those three, beginning with sex. Where in the ancient world, the ancient pagan world that Paul would have been very familiar with, of course, would this have been playing itself out?
Yes. I define three basic elements of paganism, or from a cultural perspective, sex, violence, and the cult of celebrity. You have to remember that the pagans of the Greeks and the Romans and so forth, they were not their worship was not the same type of worship that we practice today in Christian orthodoxy. In fact, the ancient Greeks and Romans practiced their devotion to the gods, of course, in particular cults, which were local in nature and gave the pagans a sense of place and work and ancestry, for example. And really, pagan piety was not a matter of inward reflection or intense private communion with God like it is with the Christian faith. For example, no Greek would have ever written in a spiritual journal. But rather, their devotion to the gods can best be summarized by the old saying, there you might see the gods in sundry shapes committing heady riots, incest, and rapes. So the dominant tone of pagan ritual was one of festivity rather than somber sanctimony. The gods delighted in seeing humans enjoying themselves, singing and dancing and athletics, crude jokes, obscene gestures, and even the occasional orgy was a part of their religious festivity. That's why Paul says in 1 Corinthians, when he describes idolatry and warning Israel not to fall into the same trap of their neighbors, he said, "Neither be idolaters, as some were, as it were." He said, "For the people sat down to eat and drink, and then they rose up to play." So this idea of festivity, pagan festivity, surrounds play, sexual exhibitionism. It's all part of the pagan way of worship.
And all of this is, you cite examples of, say, Roman emperors. It's all expressed as a spectacle, as something to be observed on a mass level, be it the gladiatorial contests, the violence, the celebrity of the emperor himself, but often emperors who were basically playing with the idea of gender, even in and sex, even in the ancient world.
Yes, and I think going back to Romans chapter 1, Paul beautifully describes it. Of course, we know his words were inspired by God himself, but the idea how this idolizing the creature over the creator has a downward spiral, and it goes from that of even changing the reverence that we should have toward the human body and switching genders all the way down to very base sexual practices. That's why he says in Romans, likewise also the men leaving the natural use of the women burned in their lust for one another, men with men committing what is shameful and receiving in themselves the penalty of their error, which was due. And when you look at what happened to Rome, Rome eventually fell into spectacle, where bread and circuses became the shout of the day, and the Colosseums were filled with gladiators, and even the occasional burning of Christians and feeding them to the lions, the gush of blood and the show of flesh. That's what Rome eventually degenerated to. And toward the twilight years, even the emperors got in on the act. And we know, for example, that some of the emperors fell into this spectacle themselves, which is very interesting because actors were barred from Roman citizenship. Nevertheless, Nero, for example, is known for his transvestism.
Today, you point out that, and you cite as an example, the 1992 presidential race between George H.W. Bush and former President Bill Clinton as kind of marking the demise of rationality in the political realm. Tell us about that.
Well, of course, I'm not the only one who has written on this. There have been a number of scholars who have addressed this particular shift. I guess that would be the best word to call it, a shift in the way we do politics. Neil Postman has written about it. Another scholar by the name of Kathleen Jameson, who's probably one of the best-known scholars on presidential advertising, has also written on it as well. But I think we can say that a definite shift occurred in the American political world when television was introduced. We might even say that when television was introduced, the party boss died. Before television, the way people were put into political office was they had to go through the political machinery. However, with television, the main goal was to become telegenic, and those who could be the most telegenic were the most electable. A perfect example, probably the example that most people are familiar with, would be the Nixon-Kennedy debates in 1960. People who listened to those debates on the radio said that Nixon won, but those who watched it on television said that Kennedy won because he appeared more youthful, he was more alert. Nixon had been sick. He had a 5 o'clock shadow, and just didn't come across very well on television. Of course, we know that Kennedy went on to win the presidency, but many people see that as a benchmark in which, if you're going to become elected today, you have to be able to be telegenic. Which I think is very important because, to some extent, our political discourse has changed, and now the same virtues that we bestow on celebrity, the power of celebrity, have now also spilled over into the political world. If you're going to be elected, you have to be television savvy.
So a pagan culture in the ancient world where an entire empire devolved into nothing more than spectacle. Everything became spectacle. Is now being reflected in the postmodern world, where our celebrities are, where everything is image, where substance and rationality are take a very distant backseat to one's public and visual image, how one presents himself in a soundbite or in pictures.
Yeah, really, before television, substance was more important, and now substance has, that is, what the candidate believes, has been superseded by spectacle. The personality of the candidate, which is intimately captured by the television screen. Really, it overwhelmed the traditional political machinery. Before television, one could confidently vote for a candidate's party label with a little worry about the platform, what platform was going to be. Everybody knew that it would be upheld. It's interesting to note that in 1996, Republican presidential nominee Bob Dole said that he had not even read his party's platform. And so to be elected today, a candidate must do what one of Nixon's aides told him to do. You must, and this is a direct quote, break away from linear logic, present a barrage of impressions. And so political discourse becomes a type of spectatorship. And we follow the personality of the leader more so than his platform. And we think about Bill Clinton, you know, despite lying to his staff, his wife, and all the American people, despite the fact that he perjured himself, and despite that he was impeached, he still received a standing ovation at the 2000 Democratic National Convention. I don't know if you remember that. I don't know if you remember watching that or can remember that evening at all. Do you remember Clinton?
I remember the long walk.
Right.
In the hallway where he appeared, at least he appeared, minus cameraman, to be making a slow walk out, kind of for his big finale. He was going to hand the torch to his vice president Al Gore, if I'm not mistaken.
Yeah, the cameras followed him through the corridors there, and out onto the stage, and there was a video tribute. Clinton, that he narrated himself, by the way. So after he appears on stage, of course, the crowd is screaming. They're playing Fleetwood Mac's Don't Stop Thinking About Tomorrow. He enters the stage area, and the delegates are dancing. And, of course, we know that political conventions have a lot of hoopla and so forth. But Bob Jones, the fourth, noted in World Magazine, he said, quote, "The roar gave way to the kind of high-pitched screaming usually reserved for rock stars." He made a speech really more about himself than Al Gore. And here he is up on stage, blushed-faced, enjoying every minute, not wanting to leave, soaking it all in. Remember, this was a man who several weeks earlier had posed provocatively on the cover of Esquire, a man who aides affectionately called him, behind closed doors, Elvis.
Dr. Arthur Hunt is our guest. He is author of the book, The Vanishing Word, The Veneration of Visual Imagery in the Postmodern World. He's also Associate Professor of Communications at Geneva College. This is the conclusion to our three-part series on an image-based culture versus a word-based culture. If you'd like to join us, our phone number is 1-800-730-2727, 1-800-730-2727. We've only got a few minutes before this break. You also cite, now this is going back before Bill Clinton. Bill Clinton wasn't the first to do this, how television as a medium, that was certainly a made-for-television event, doesn't just downplay rationality, it sometimes requires irrationality, and you cite the 1964 Johnson television commercial for Lyndon B. Johnson when he was running against Barry Goldwater. Tell us about that very briefly. We've got about a minute and a half.
Okay. We have to remember that really the political speech that was the hallmark of a candidate running for office has been replaced, I think, and I think others would agree with me, with the political spot ad. And so now, if a president wants to, or a person running for office, if they want to get their message out, they have to do so in sound bites with political spot ads. That's the way it's done today. That's another big shift that has occurred in this country. We've gone from the age in which people would actually attend a political party's candidates debating each other, like with the Lincoln-Douglas debates, where people actually sat raptured for hours listening to these men. Even Lincoln, in one of the debates, not having enough time, it was dinner time, and he dismissed the crowd and said, "Come back in an hour after dinner, and we'll finish these debates up." And what's so remarkable is they actually did it. Today, we sit in church, and at 12 o'clock noon, our wristwatch alarms are going off telling us it's time for the preacher to shut up. We don't have a very long attention span. So political discourse has also fallen into this as well. Perfect example is during the 1960s when Johnson ran a commercial against Barry Goldwater, in which we have a picture of a little girl picking petals off the flower, counting down, and then this is juxtaposed to this image of this nuclear warhead going off, and the message is that you cannot trust Barry Goldwater, that this is a man who has his finger on the red button. Well, that type of political discourse is irrational because it only consists of a claim based upon pictures, which are really emotional appeals rather than logical appeals.
Let's talk more about that when we come back from this break. Dr. Arthur Hunt is our guest. You can purchase Dr. Arthur Hunt's new book. It's called The Vanishing Word, The Veneration of Visual Imagery in the Postmodern World, directly through our radio program, folks. We'll send you the book for a contribution of $15 to Issues, Etc. That price includes shipping and handling. Have your MasterCard, your Visa, or your Discover card ready and call the Issues Etc. resource line during this break. Here's the number, 1-800-737-0172. 1-800-737-0172. The book you asked for is called The Vanishing Word by Dr. Arthur Hunt, or you can make your $15 check payable to Issues Etc. and mail it to us at Box 9360, St. Louis, Missouri, 63117. Box 9360, St. Louis, Missouri, 63117. 1-800-737-0172.
The radio voice of the Lutheran faith for the 21st century. You're listening to Issues, Etc.
If Christian doctrine can be true or false, can Christian practice also be true or false? Is Christian practice always neutral? What's the relationship between Christian doctrine and Christian practice? Hi, this is Todd Wilkin. You'll find answers to these questions in the latest edition of the Issues Etc. Journal. I've written an article titled Doctrine and Practice, and you can receive a complimentary copy of the Issues Etc. Journal by calling our resource line, 1-800-737-0172. I've also written an article on the Lord's Supper titled Responding to Real Absence Arguments. Plus, you'll find a list of tape and book resources on issues such as American evangelicalism, church history, biblical interpretation, and much more. Ask to receive a complimentary copy of the Issues Etc. Journal, 1-800-737-0172.
Noah's Flood, did it really happen?
Answers with Ken Ham, Australian lecturer and author. Well, Ken, is there any evidence of Noah's flood anywhere around the world?
Well, the Bible teaches us that about 4,500 years ago, water covered the entire earth. Now, there would have also been volcanic eruptions, because the Bible speaks about the fountains of the Great Deep breaking up. It would have been a catastrophic event, and only those land animals on the ark would have survived. Actually, if Noah's flood were true, you'd expect to find billions of dead things buried in rock layers, laid down by water all over the earth. And you know what we do find? Well, billions of dead things buried in rock layers, laid down by water all over the earth. You know, it's fascinating when you talk to people who tell you there's no evidence for a global flood anywhere on earth. They say, but all you see are billions of dead things buried in rock layers, laid down by water. Well, you know the saying. Actually, the evidence for the flood is all over the globe. It's a sobering reminder that God has judged this world with a catastrophic flood. And it should be a warning also. He's going to judge again, but next time not by water, by fire. And just as Noah and his family had to go through a doorway to be saved from the judgment to come, we have an ark of salvation, the Lord Jesus Christ, so we can be saved from the judgment to come.
In addition to Noah's flood, one of the most asked questions we receive here at the Answers Ministry relates to the accuracy of carbon dating. Well, you can read our eye-opening free booklet on dating methods at our website, AnswersRadio.com.
At AM 850 KFUO, the weather for St. Louis. Overnight cloudy and cooler, thunderstorms and showers are likely, low of about 56. Tuesday looks like this, partly cloudy, breezy, and cooler. Rain may be in our forecast also on Tuesday, high near 69. Right now, mostly cloudy and 78 in St. Louis.
All right, issues, etc. junkies, here's something just for you. It's a confessional Christian worldview seminar, June the 20th through the 27th at the Schwann Center in northern Wisconsin. We'll be there broadcasting live along with Issues Etc. regular guests, Rolf Preuss, Angus Manoos, George Mather, and Craig Parton. Here are some of the topics that they'll be discussing at this seminar: Islam, Catholicism Today, Postmodernism and Hypersecularism, Theological Liberalism, Defending the Biblical Worldview, and more. Now, $229 covers the seminar, lodging, and meals for a week. Call the Schwann Center today at 1-800-577-4848 and ask for information on a Confessional Christian Worldview Seminar, June 20th through the 27th in Trago, Wisconsin. 1-800-577-4848. Or find information at our website, issuesetc.org.
Welcome back to Issues Etc. I'm Todd Wilkin. Dr. Arthur Hunt is our guest. We're concluding our three-part series on an image-based culture versus a word-based culture. He's Associate Professor of Communications at Geneva College and author of the new book titled The Vanishing Word, The Veneration of Visual Imagery in the Postmodern World.
He's starting at Geneva this coming fall.
Oh, so you're just about to begin there as an associate professor of communications.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
All right. Well, we'll just jump the gun a bit on that if we could. Before the break, you were talking about President Bill Clinton in particular, his long walk in that Democratic National Convention that everyone saw on television. Now, many American evangelicals during that time and leading up to that point observed that president, and they not only saw through the slick, highly staged, but made to look like it was completely unstaged, the highly produced, packaged image that was that president. They saw right through it, and they decried it. And yet, many of the same Christians, during the Sunday morning worship hour, were subjected to precisely the same tricks by their pastors and their worship teams, and they fell for it hook, line, and sinker.
It's odd, I suppose, for us not to get the connection there. Of course, I think that we are seeing a major shift in worship. Worship is becoming much more subjective. It's becoming much more existential, really, where the preachers are trying to address the felt needs of the congregation. And I think that not only has electronic media, television, etc., not only has it shaped public discourse in the political arena, But it is now, and I believe this really started to pick up steam in the 90s. It is now spilled over into the way we worship. So the entertainment values of Hollywood has now spilled over into the way we worship, and you see it cropping up in a number of different ways, whether it be shorter sermons, music which really is more man-centered or feeling-centered as opposed to exalting God and His holiness. We even see brazen attempts to draw audiences in, everything from preachers staging an ascension into heaven by wires and smoke and fireworks to having wrestling on the stage, like pro wrestling, just to draw a crowd. And it's just how it shows you how media technology can shape our information environment. And I think the church is a very important way in which we receive information, the most important information there is to receive, and that's about God's word.
The typical billboard for the non-denominational, the big mega church, usually looks pretty much the same. It's got a very good-looking pastor and his family. Usually they are both well-dressed, nice teeth, good-looking. The kids may be in attendance there, and they're just the model of American childhood. And the image there, now this not only appears on billboards, but also sometimes in the television commercials as well. Is the cult of personality at work in the church as well? You talk about it being in the culture.
The cult of personality, that's a good way to describe it. The celebrity culture, I think it has become pervasive in the church. And, of course, my best definition of celebrity comes from Daniel Borstein, and it means someone who is known for their well-knownness. In other words, a celebrity is someone who really didn't do anything to earn the attention that we give him or her. Rather, they are celebrities because they are known for their well-knownness. Of course, in the world that we live in today, in American culture, we idolize celebrities. We exalt them. We attend to them. The cult of personality. So, yeah, I think that has spilled over. And I, of course, if you note ministries that have large broadcasts, for example. And where there is a large component of the worship service is the fact that it's being televised, that in those, and not all, there are exceptions, but in many of them, there is this cult of personality that surrounds the preacher. And the preacher is very well dressed, a very good speaker, good looking, very dynamic. It's very interesting to contrast that with somebody, say, like Calvin, who was kind of weakly and even frail, in which he's best known for his great intellectual abilities and his ability to explain and preach the word of God, but he did not have the charisma that many of the personalities we see on the television screen today. I'm afraid Calvin wouldn't look very well on television.
You know, Luther is known for his rotundity, and he wasn't the best-looking guy in the world. He had bad hair on most days. I just don't think he could qualify to be the pastor of a Christian megachurch in this culture.
No, I don't think he would make it. I don't think Jonathan Edwards necessarily would have fared as well either. It's funny to think about those questions. Well, hey, how would Edwards do on television today? He's known for his sermon, Sinners in the Hands of an Angry God. First of all, you probably wouldn't hear very much preaching like that on television. He wasn't that concerned with the felt needs of his congregation, in as much as he was about declaring the beauties of God's holiness and our need for him as a sinner.
I was talking to somebody from Christian History Magazine about Jonathan Edwards recently, and he said Edwards was known for, not for a dynamic preaching style. In fact, he was known for a monotone preaching style, mm-hmm. but the people were so deeply moved by sermons like the one you just mentioned and others. In fact, the first time that one was preached, Sinners in the Hands of an Angry God, Edwards said it went over like a lump of coal. But the second time it was preached, it had its effect. But they were moved by the content, by the words themselves, and not
right.
by the spectacle of the preacher.
Yeah, and you have to remember that these people could listen to sermons that were 2 hours long. What would happen if someone preached us a sermon that was 2 hours long or 3 hours long today? They'd probably be ran off.
You
we just don't have attention spans to, nor the mental capabilities of listening to a sermon like Sinners in the Hands of an Angry God.
You have written, if we know what lies behind a particular medium, and that's what we're really talking about here, the effect of the medium upon the message, why we don't hear those sermons anymore, because the medium cannot bear the weight of those things. If we know what lies behind a particular medium, we are able to point out how it works and why it sways people the way it does. Then we can lessen its power over us. Tell us how.
Well, that's one reason I wrote the book. And really what I'm engaging in is what I like to call Todoism. Todo was the little dog on The Wizard of Oz. And you might remember in that movie, and forgive me for using an illustration from electronic media to make a point about electronic media, but Toto, the little dog, pulled back the curtain to reveal the man operating the machine that was actually the projecting the image and scaring Dorothy and the straw man and so forth. And that's really what I'm engaging in. I'm pulling back the curtain so we can see what we sometimes don't readily see. Because we swim in a world of images, fish don't see, don't think about the water that they're swimming in. And these changes have slowly crept up on us over 100 years, and so we're oblivious to it. So what I'm doing is saying, you know, things didn't always used to be this way.
You have written also, idolatry is predicated on the eye gate. The pagan walks by sight, whereas the Christian is to walk by faith based upon the revealed logos, that is, the word. What do you mean by these things?
Well, of course, paganism is image-based. That is not to say that all pagans couldn't read. I will say that it was the Jews who first, the Hebrew people who first tried to educate all their people. They wanted all their people to be able to read, not just an elite governmental bureaucracy. In order to carry out the workings of the empire, but the Hebrew people wanted all of their people to be able to learn the scriptures. So literacy was vitally important. Literacy is not vitally important in pagan cultures because of the supremacy of the image and the fact that most pagan cultures are totalitarian. Christianity inherited the word-based modes of learning from the Hebrews, and we are to be a people of the book. That's why literacy is extremely important for us as Christians, to be able to read. Because we have to read the Bible. Our faith, the Christian faith, cannot exist without a high value, the high value of literacy in our communities, in our Christian communities, in contrast with paganism, which is image based.
We're talking with Dr. Arthur Hunt about an image based culture versus a word based culture, concluding our series. Dr. Hunt, should you said Christianity inherited the word based instruction, the word based way of life. Should Christians not only know how to read, be literate, but also be able to think as well?
Absolutely. And I think this is very, it's very sad that our worship services are becoming decapitated. We're losing our head. We are cutting off the intellectual part of worship. And we're going to more subjectivism and more emotionalism. And I think this is a very bad trend. We talked about the Puritans and Edwards and people like that. Edwards aimed at the heart, and the heart consisted of the head and or the intellect and the emotions. But the emotions came from knowing. In other words, you first have to understand God as revealed in His Word. And then if there's an emotional reaction to that, that's fine. And of course, Edwards was dealing with this very thing during the Great Awakening, because there was excessive emotionalism that Edwards saw some of it as being false, but he wasn't against emotionalism per se if it flowed out of a true knowledge and a true understanding of God. Today, what we have, though, is no intellectualism or no true knowledge of God, and rather pure emotionalism, and which is radically different from the outpourings of the Holy Spirit during the Great Awakening, when we had a man stand up and preach for an hour the depths of God's Word.
And it seems as though the other thing that is distinctive there or contrasted there was that Edwards and so many others as well, we've mentioned Calvin and Luther, when they entered the pulpit to preach, they actually preached an objective truth, that is Christ and Him crucified, and that the sinner figured into the equation only as the one for whom Christ had died, the one who was on God's wrong side because of his rebellion and sin, the one for whom whose sins Christ had paid, now have the forgiveness of sins freely by God's grace. Whereas it seems today, Christian preaching is far more self-referential, so much more that it's not about Jesus, it's about us.
Right. There's a lot of psychology and self-esteem mixed in with its success. And as a result, nobody knows the Bible anymore. I talk about my book, Different Forms of Illiteracy. One of those forms is biblical illiteracy. We don't know what the Bible says. Interestingly, the Barna Group did some research, and they consistently have discovered that Americans have irrational religious beliefs. According to Barna, while 60% of Americans believe that the Bible is totally accurate in all of its teachings, nearly 40% believe that while Jesus was on earth, he committed sins. That's irrational. While 81% of Americans believe that Christ was born to a virgin, 40% deny his resurrection. That doesn't make any sense. And so I think there is a watering down of basic Christian doctrines, doctrines of the fall and sin and eternal punishment, grace, the authority of Christ over our lives, and these things that take a back seat. And their theology has been upstaged with spectacle.
You talk about, you know, someone's going to say, look, the response to this is, now I know that no medium and the media are and the technology are not neutral. They affect the message. And I have listened to the series, and now I can see the many and great things that have been forfeited and forsaken because of an embrace of the technology and the various media. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to take the Luddite stand. I'm going to avoid all medium. I'm just going to go back to the basics, and I'll only get my information or only get my stuff from the printed word. But you say no. And you also say no to the other side of the thing, which is to be militant about it. Why resistance?
Well, we certainly can't go back to 100 years, 200 years ago. That's impossible. We have to live with it. And the case that I make is that we have to go into the future with our eyes wide open, as Neil Postman coins it. That means we need to be aware of the culture, the information environment that we're swimming in. And yes, take measures to structure our lives so that we don't get caught up in the idolization process. What does that mean in a very practical way? Well, it means I'm going to monitor what I watch. For example, I'm going to monitor, for example, how much television I watch, and I'm going to monitor how much I watch. There is no law that says that the television has to be the nucleus of the home, that we have to wrap our lives around it and have the television on 40 hours a week. Why do we do that? We don't have to do that. Don't we have enough motivation to govern how we're going to use our time, how we're going to spend our time? So I think we ought to be very conscious of our leisure habits. Take charge of our leisure habits. At the same time, I think it's very important that we understand different media out there. That's why I believe in media literacy programs and a discipline called media ecology, which asks the question, what are our technologies doing to us? Because the question has always been, what can technology do for us? That's what we spend all of our energy on these days. But my point is that we need to back off and say, okay, what is this doing to me? What is this doing to our world? And become informed in that way.
So in a sense, with television, an example, but it could also be the movies, or when we step into that church on Sunday morning with the big Jumbotron screen up front and the spectacle all prepared for to dazzle the eye, we ask ourselves, we take a critical stance, that is not a criticizing stance, but a critical stance where we say, what is this doing to me?
Mm-hmm.
And we observe not only the medium, but ourselves observing the medium.
Right, because the American tendency is to embrace all technological progress and deem it as being good without considering its ill consequences. So when we put a big fat screen in the middle of our church, somebody ought to pause and think, okay, what is this going to do to our worship service to have the preacher 40 foot high? What is that? Because our attention span, I mean, our attention, our visual attention is going to be at that. And we need to think about that.
And is putting up the screen going to raise the question, well, it's there, we got to use it for something?
Right. That's the mindlessness that I'm talking about. The technology exists, therefore we need to use it. Well, who says we need to use it? What was wrong with our church service before they had big screens?
Dr. Arthur Hunt, thank you very much for being our guest on Issues, Etc.
Well, it's my pleasure, Todd.
Dr. Arthur Hunt is Associate Professor of Communications at Geneva College. He'll begin that position very shortly. He's author of the new book called The Vanishing Word, The Veneration of Visual Imagery in the Postmodern World. Folks, if you'd like to receive a complimentary copy of our Issues Etc. journal, or if you'd like to purchase Dr. Arthur Hunt's new book called The Vanishing Word for a total of $15, or if you'd like to make a donation to Issues Etc., call our resource line, 1-800-737-0172. That's 1-800-737-0172. You can also write us at Issues Etc., Box 9360, St. Louis, Missouri, 63117. That's Box 9360, St. Louis, Missouri, 63117. This is probably the greatest danger that we face. You know, we live in a very safe society, where, by and large, at least in American culture, technology doesn't present a danger to us. We have been taught that technology is good. It has improved the quality of life in so many areas, it's almost impossible to calculate it. But the Christian church has been entrusted with a message, the message of the gospel, Jesus Christ and Him crucified, that bows to no technology. And let's not be naive. The media, every medium, and our technology, as much good as it has done for us, also does things to us and to the message. If we are naive and say it's all neutral and it's all good, we are simply failing to see and failing to take into account that this message of Christ and Him crucified for all sinners bows to no technology. And technologies come at a price. They change the news, they change our entertainment, they change the way we think. They change the way we observe reality around us and what we think about that. They change our ability to think. Why can't our kids read when they get out of high school? Perhaps because they spent so much time not reading, but watching. Why can't Christians think? Perhaps they've been encouraged by the new media in the church not to do it. And yet this message, what does Paul say? Faith comes by hearing, and hearing by the word of God. God has given to us, the church, a word-based culture. Not just that, a word-based salvation. It is upon His promises, His objective word, founded in Jesus Christ, that everything depends. And that message of the forgiveness of sins, no matter how good the technology is, cannot bow to the media. I'm Todd Wilkin. Thanks for listening to Issues Etc.
Listen weekday afternoons to Issues Etc. Issues Etc. is a listener-supported program. Your financial support is critical for Issues Etc. to continue. Our address is Post Office Box 9360, St. Louis, Missouri, 63117. Or you can contact us via our website at www.issuesetc.org. That's www.issuesetc.org. For a cassette copy of the program, call 1-800-737-0172. That's 1-800-737-0172. Opinions expressed are not necessarily those of this station or the Jubilee Network. Issues Etc. is a broadcast service of the Lutheran Church, Missouri Synod.